welcome to another episode of Bowel Sounds, the pediatric GI podcast, the official podcast of the North American Society of Pediatric Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition, or NASPGHAN. I'm Tamara Hedja. I'm a pediatric gastroenterologist at Cincinnati Children's, and I'm joined today by my lovely co-host, Dr. Jen Lee from Nationwide Children's in Columbus, Ohio. How are you, Jen?
Hey, Tamara. How are you doing?
I'm doing good.
Hey, I just got back from the NASPGHAN Junior Faculty Conference that was hosted in Dallas. Didn't you go last year?
I did. I loved it. I loved every single bit of it. How is it this year?
So shout out to Chris Lee and Rena Sangvi, former Bowel Sounds guests who organized the conference. I thought it was amazing. I think it was one of the most impactful conferences I've been to in a long time, just because it was just really relevant to things that we were going through, meeting other faculty in similar areas of career development, and just talking about really relevant things for like a really busy couple days. So glad that I went.
Yeah, it was amazing. It was kind of like the first year, second year, third year fellows conferences, but even better. You're like a faculty, you know where you are, you know what you want to do, or some of us don't. And it's just like you're sitting there and learning really important and relevant things related to your current career. So it's amazing. It's a
really great time. I really hope that we're able to continue doing that long term. I think there's probably going to be a call you have to submit. They ask for some information, so not everybody is able to go. So once you see that call for submissions, definitely if you're a junior faculty from 2 to 7 years out of fellowship, think about applying for next year. It is really cool.
Yes, for sure, for sure. And last year when we went, it was in Chicago. Your year, it was in Dallas.
Yeah, somewhere warm.
Yeah. Really nice. I wonder where it is next year.
I don't know. Hey, Chris and Rena, let us know. But it's also cool because you get to collaborate with people from all over the country and get to meet them. And that is one of the cool things about our episode today, because we are talking about surgery in ulcerative colitis. And we have two guests today. Do you want to introduce our guest, Tamara?
Yes. So Dr. Michael Rosen is a professor of pediatrics and a pediatric gastroenterologist. He is the director of the Stanford Medical Children's Health Center for IBD and celiac disease. Dr. McMahon is the surgery chair at Phoenix Children's, and she specializes in colorectal surgery and thoracic surgery at Phoenix Children's. And both of them tell us about how to manage a patient with ulcerative colitis that is close to getting a surgical colectomy.
Yeah, really a lot of really good information. Definitely want to bookmark for when you have a patient who maybe experienced this, or even just in general, like as you're preparing for your boards or whatever. It's a lot of really great content here. Shall we?
Yes.
On to the show.
On to the show. Welcome, Dr. McMahon and Dr. Rosen, to Bowel Sounds. It's good to have you. I've been looking forward to this episode for so long, just because, Dr. Rosen, you're one of my favorite people. I actually remember you from DDW. I remember you from DDW when you asked me a question when I was presenting, and I was like, oh. And Dr. McMahon, my brother knows you, and he said you are one of the best surgeons he's ever worked with. So welcome both.
Thank you.
Thank you. The feeling's quite mutual, and it's an honor to be here. I was one of the early listeners from the beginning of Bowel Sounds, and I continue to be an avid one.
You're definitely one of the longtime podcast supporters. So we are very happy to have you today. So we're going to start with our first question. And a lot of our listeners feel like this is a challenging question. And this is for both of you. How would you describe yourself in one sentence to our listeners?
So I for the purposes of this podcast, I'm a pediatric surgeon at Phoenix Children's, and I subspecialized in IBD and chest wall. So here's my sentence.
That's a great one. That's that's one sentence. Dr. Rosen, how do you follow that?
I've been waiting a long time for this, but I think it will be underwhelming. I am a pediatric gastroenterologist and physician scientist who cares deeply about advancing care for children with IBD and celiac disease, mentoring, family, and anything that has to do with Star Wars, but not necessarily in that order.
I've never watched any Star Wars movies.
We'll have a lot to talk about this. Yeah, for sure. For sure. So just so everyone caught this, you are not working in the same center. So we are going to be talking about a multidisciplinary approach for children who may need surgery for ulcerative colitis. So we might put you on the spot a little bit since different places practice a little bit differently. So just calling that out, we're so excited that you're game to have this conversation with us. Lisa, if we were going to go visit Phoenix, what would you recommend to do out there?
Well, I love Phoenix and I love hiking here. There is so much hiking in the city, outside of the city. You can drive 2 hours and get to an entirely different environment if you want. But if you are just staying here in Phoenix, there are trails all over and mountains everywhere. So that's what I like to do. Every day I hike. So it's my favorite thing.
Awesome. And then, Michael, what about the Bay Area? What do you recommend out that area?
I have a similar answer. You got to get outside here. The weather's beautiful and there's so many beautiful places to visit outdoors. So just 20 minutes away from Palo Alto where I'm at is Half Moon Bay, beautiful nice. Bluffs over the Pacific Ocean. Go visit Redwoods in the state parks near Santa Cruz within an hour, hour and a half, or do a hike and see the Bay and the Golden Gate Bridge in the Marin Headlands, about an hour north.
Oh, I love that. And actually, Lisa, one of my friends who's in the cycling group that I'm a part of here in Columbus is doing the Ironman in like a week there in Phoenix. So they say it's a really cool place to be outside.
Yeah, it's just now getting cool, actually, when you speak of temperature. It has been warm this year, and the only time that it's usually really nice is early in the mornings, at least nice enough to go and cycle or hike or do something outdoors until now. Now it's gorgeous all the time.
And awesome. Flagstaff is not far away from you, right?
Flagstaff is 2 hours away, and then one more hour from there is the Grand Canyon, which is spectacular. And it is freezing, and it is snowing up there. It's a completely different climate.
Yeah, I remember driving through there to the Grand Canyon. And Michael, Redwoods, oh, those are my favorite trees ever. They are so amazing, so big, so dark red. They're amazing. I love it. So like Jen said, we're going to talk about IBD, but specifically surgery in IBD. And you kind of said your first, the one-liner about your background. And Lisa, it's amazing to find a successful female surgeon. Every time I see a female surgeon, I'm like, yes, that's amazing. And like I said, my brother really admires you. And he says you're one of the best surgeons that he's ever worked with. How did you develop your interest in surgery?
Well, I had no idea I wanted to do surgery until I actually did the rotation. So it just takes me a while to know that I like something. So when I was in medical school, I thought I was going to do OB because that was my first rotation and that was my first experience in the operating room. And then my last rotation was surgery. And I thought, oh, well, I'm just going to do this rotation. It'll be fine. And then I fell in love with it. And that was it. So I have to actually experience something to know that I like it. It was not easy in the sense that people would say things like, you're too nice to be a surgeon. Well, maybe you can do breast. And I got that kind of thing all the way through. So you're right in the respect that it's a little bit more difficult for women. But I think if you just stick with it, you can do anything, right? Like just like anybody, man or woman.
That's amazing. That's really great. And yeah, all respect to all surgeons. I don't think I can be a surgeon. I like to sleep. And Michael, how did you first develop your interest in IBD?
Yeah, well, you know, I went to college pretty committed to going to medical school. My father's a physician. He's a big influence in my life.
Nice.
But my freshman year of college, I actually was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. And so I had that personal experience that sort of directed my interest as I entered medical school. And so in medical school, I did research in inflammatory bowel disease with some incredible mentors and got hooked in that way. And this topic is near and dear to my heart because actually my fourth year of medical school, medicines were not working for me. This was before infliximab was approved for ulcerative colitis. And I actually underwent myself a colectomy in ileopalatinal wow. anastomosis or IPAA.
Thanks for sharing with us your story. This is very inspiring. And I'm sure you kind of, with your story, you're inspiring a lot of upcoming doctors or people that want to go into the medical field. So thank you for sharing that with us.
I know. And I think I put this in the email, but in our pre-communication, but one of the messages that I really hope that this podcast, specifically about ulcerative colitis and surgery, is that really shifting that view of surgery as being a failure towards surgery as being another treatment option that might actually be right for you or for your child or for your patient. And so I really hope that we can get that message across. So Dr. Rosen, you know, I mentioned earlier that a multidisciplinary team is so important in the care of our patients. Do you mind talking about what comprises an ideal multidisciplinary IBD surgical team?
Yeah, well, you know, I think, you know, first and foremost, you need to have a surgeon with experience performing complex surgery for ulcerative colitis in children. And it's incredibly important that the gastroenterologist and the surgeon have completely open lines of communication and operate, no pun intended, as a dyad in the care of these patients. Outside of that, and Lisa may, you know, have some strong opinions about this too, but certainly on the surgical team, nurses with experience caring for these patients, including nurses with expertise in stoma care and planning. And then, you know, as children are going to surgery, I think, you know, part of this interdisciplinary team is the same interdisciplinary team that we think is such a strength for children in their medical care. So they're going to have certainly psychosocial needs, school needs. So social worker, psychologist, dietitian, certainly, as you're approaching and coming out of surgery. And then the added bonus, I think, particularly after surgery, that can be very helpful if you have this resource, is a pelvic floor physical therapist that can help with issues that might arise after surgery for ulcerative colitis.
I love that because, you know, you mentioned a lot of the medical care team that we have. And then there's obviously surgical colleagues who are involved in not all of our patients with IBD. So when do you start to introduce your patients to that surgical part of the team?
So we're focusing on ulcerative colitis. You know, this has been we've been moving the goalposts on this one. So when I started training, I can remember a time when we were offering surgery, you know, side by side with infliximab for acute severe ulcerative colitis. And certainly for many years, we said, well, if you're starting infliximab as a rescue therapy after a patient has failed intravenous corticosteroids, you need to be introducing them to a surgeon at that time. I think with our improved outcomes and optimization of infliximab in that setting, fewer of us are necessarily bringing up surgery quite then. And that's probably appropriate. But after a patient has not responded to infliximab, particularly if they have more severe disease and ulcerative colitis, I would say that's the latest time point to introduce them to a surgeon. But particularly if they're asking questions, the short answer is don't wait too long to introduce them to a surgeon. I don't think there's any time that's particularly too early, particularly if they express an interest in understanding that option.
That's true. And I think, you know, surgeons are not scary people. Like Lisa, we're just meeting. You don't seem scary. I think it'd be great so I think what I'm hearing is really earlier the better. If you start going in that direction, it's probably better to bring everyone on board.
Yeah. What you absolutely don't want to do is you don't want to be introducing them to a surgeon when that is the absolute only option you have in front of you. Because patients do, and their families do need a little bit of time to accommodate this option in their brain and their psyche. It takes a little time to be accepting of it and to think about the possibilities, you know, with a surgery for ulcerative colitis, and focus the mind on the great outcomes that can occur, and less so on what seems like at its first instance a somewhat extreme, you know, option. So it does take some time for them to wrap their head around it and gain some acceptance.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's kind of hear the surgeon's point of view. Dr. McMahon, since our listeners are mostly gastroenterologists, and we heard Michael say an early introduction to a surgeon is great, how can we best prepare our patients and their families for that initial consultation with a surgical colleague? And how does that appointment look like?
Yeah, well, like Dr. Rosen said, just having the discussion about surgery, even as an option in talking about different treatment plans for ulcerative colitis, like saying the word, I think is hard for some people, but I do think that that's really important. And so in terms of preparing them, I would say, you know, surgery is an option. I'd like you to meet our surgeon that is part of our team for IBD. This is something that we do for all of our patients who have whatever stage you are in terms of your UC care at your institution. Sometimes here, I feel like I'm seeing mainly patients in the hospital for acute severe ulcerative colitis, as opposed to anybody in clinic. I would say it's maybe 2% that I'm seeing in clinic for the discussion about surgery. So it's generally folks who are in the hospital. They're obviously stressed. They don't necessarily want to talk to yet another doctor when their kid isn't feeling well. But I think just setting them up to say this is an option is, most people are open to it. They want the information. They just want to have the tools available to them to make good decisions. And so really, it's just giving them options, giving them education.
So we obviously kind of heard Michael say, if a patient fails infliximab, then that's when you would want to introduce them to a surgeon. So instead of them being in the hospital and sick, we send them to you. The most scary thing for a patient to hear about surgery is the stoma. Do you bring that up on the first visit?
Oh, yeah. So the first visit is, if somebody is talking to me about surgery, then I give them all the information. I want them to be very well prepared and understand what they're potentially getting themselves into. And I know that the stoma is scary, but sometimes people mourn the loss of a colon, which is an interesting thing that I have come to see lately that I didn't first understand. But it's about an hour-long conversation that we have. I have to find time in my day to make this happen. And I make sure that the parents are there. And if one parent can't be there, then they're on the telephone so that they can hear everything. Or sometimes they even record it so that they can listen to it afterwards. But I sit down with a family and talk to them about really what the different stages of the procedure are that I do based on how their child is, depending on kind of where they are in their UC and what medications they're on, how sick they are, that kind of thing. And then we talk about the urgency also depending on how sick they are as well, if there is urgency or not, and just kind of methodically go through what the different operations are and what to expect.
Can you do that? Not in an hour, because the whole podcast is an hour. But Lisa, can you actually walk us through the surgical treatments and what factors are involved to help you decide, are we going forward with an ostomy? How many steps do we take? Are you doing open, laparoscopic? Can you give us the Cliff Note version of that?
I'll do my best. Okay, yes. So because the majority of my children are acute severe ulcerative colitis, they have been on steroids. They may still be on steroids. They have gotten their infliximab, maybe 3 doses in a very short period of time. They have failed. Potentially, they've been on a lot of other biologics as well. And so maybe have already failed their infliximab before, have come in with another flare, or on their 3rd or 4th medication. And so they are kids that are failing. These are not kids that are healthy. And so when I'm talking to them, I'm talking to them about a laparoscopic colectomy with a stoma, protecting ileostomy. And so when I talk about surgery for UC, I kind of start off with, well, you know, your colon's job is to mainly absorb fluid, so water, and then your rectum's job is a storage device. It stores the poop until you're socially able to go and have a bowel movement. And in ulcerative colitis surgery, those are the parts that we're removing. So we do it in three stages when you're sick like this. At least I do. I'm very conservative. I take the colon out first laparoscopically. It's three little baby incisions and one larger one where the stoma is going to be. And where the stoma is actually where you take your colon out. So generally, it's a procedure that takes about 2.5 to 3.5 hours, and you are asleep for it. We give you good pain medication and make sure that you're nice and numb, and the anesthesiologist will talk about different kinds of blocks that they can do to make it more comfortable for you. But basically, it will look like very little surgery on the outside, and in the end, you'll end up with a stoma, but it is big surgery on the inside. It will make you feel better after you recover from surgery fairly quickly. Once you have your stoma, you're going to not have the same pain that you had, and you will not be stooling blood anymore. And your ability to recover and be able to maintain your nutrition will be a lot better because you're not going to be losing protein every time you poop. So that's sort of the advantage of it. The outcome is that you will have a stoma because you need to have poop go out somewhere. And our stoma nurse is going to talk to you about that before we have surgery. We want to make sure that you feel comfortable with this. And don't worry, you will be an expert in the stoma after a very short period of time. And if you have any problems at all, we are here and our stoma nurse will see you and troubleshoot. They're experts at this. And so you guys are going to work together and it'll be not so bad. And there are kids who name their stomas things so that if it makes noise or does anything, they can say, oh, Stanley, that's Stanley acting up, or whatever your dog's name, or your mom even. So kind of cute what they
I
do.
I had a patient
I love that.
Name his stoma after his grandfather. I think his grandfather's name was John or something like that. And he's because my grandfather's full of shit. So, I thought that was hilarious.
You know, this is just a random question I just thought of, but what is the most common question that people ask you? Like what question do they have about the stoma?
Can you make it stop? Can you control it? They want to know if they can poop out of a stoma the same way they poop out of their bottoms. And the answer is no. It stuff will come out when it comes out. They also ask about diet. Is there anything that they need to do differently in terms of eating? And so the answer to that is yes. And especially in the first couple of weeks after they have their stoma, there's some swelling there. So I'd want to make sure that they don't have anything that's really high fiber or stuff that can get stuck. And I talk about mushrooms and corn on the cob and too many gummy bears that get stuck there and shoot right through. And one that I didn't think about until I saw it happen was oranges. In January, we get great oranges here. They're delicious. And some people will not just eat one. They will eat 5 or 6 and the pulp gets stuck. It's just too much non-digestible fiber to go through. So
it gets stuck going into the bag?
Gets stuck at the level of the fascia. So if you get a big blob that comes through, the fascia doesn't open or close. It's a fixed amount. I mean, your muscles can close a little bit around it, but you can't really relax that very well to let poop through. Yeah. So it's just going to come out or not. So there are certain things that just get super stuck.
Are this similar to what you hear, Michael? Like, or do patients ask you different questions than the surgeon?
Well, patients, when we're first talking about it, they often have a lot of misconceptions about the surgery. I mean, you'd be surprised how many patients, you know, think that their only option is to have a permanent stoma. And so a lot of the initial conversation is dispelling some of those myths they have about what's to come or what the options are.
So, Michael, let's kind of talk about the next step. So you sent patients to the surgeon. They're on their second or third biologic, and they know that surgery is an option right here. What is your conversation with the family, kind of stepwise, and how it would look like? And about the stoma.
Yeah, well, I walk the family through the surgical procedure as well in my practice and explain to them that depending on the severity, but when it's more severe and you would have this done in three stages, that you would have a temporary stoma for, it just depends on the number of stages, but several months at least. But that the ultimate goal would be to create a pouch out of the small bowel that's connected to your bottom so that you're going in the same way you do now for your anus. I talk about the expected function ultimately after a J-pouch surgery, which is, and it does take some time to adapt and get there, but normal function about a year after surgery would be to have between 4 and 6 bowel movements a day. 4 is probably on the low side, and between 0 and 1 bowel movements at night. Some people need to wake up to have a bowel movement, but to be continent, to be able to hold it if they need to for even several hours, to not have bleeding, to not have pain, to be able to get back to normal activities with essentially no restrictions, to be able to eat much more of what they'd like. And we talk about the likelihood that they won't need to be on advanced IBD meds, which I put at about 80%.
Yeah, to eat what they want, but not like 5 oranges like I did yesterday.
And I was actually laughing because this is only audio, but Lisa's over here nodding too, which I think is so important because even though, you know, you're practicing at different sites, it seems like this conversation about the next steps, it's very similar no matter where you are. But if you're working directly with that person, I think it's really important to be providing the same messaging and not confusing the picture. So awesome. I don't think that we planned for that, but that was kind of cool to watch.
The other thing I'd add, I think is important, is from the gastroenterologist standpoint, things are changing. So we're having many new classes of medicines come out within a month. But in the last month, there were 4 new medicines. And so until we have more evidence, it does become difficult to decide, like, when is enough with the medications. And certainly the more biologics and advanced molecules, the small molecules that you fail, it seems there are diminishing returns on the next one. But it's not impossible that you respond to the next one. And that's a hard shared decision-making to walk the patient through. But what I do tell them, especially when they've failed, you know, 2 advanced therapies, is that your best chance of getting back to your normal activities in sort of the most reliable way is going to be a surgery. Because there, the chance of feeling well and restoring function is in like the 80, 90% range. Whereas, you know, the next new medicine, especially if you failed others, is probably closer to 20, 30%.
And Lisa, this is kind of an added question, but when you take that colon out, how does it look?
It depends on how sick the colon is, honestly. Ulcerative colitis is a mucosal disease. So often on the outside, I don't see a whole lot. Sometimes there can be what I call injection, but it's really just extra blood vessels external to the colon, more likely on the left side than on the right side. Sometimes it's hard and again, weird terms, but hard and woody. It's shortened and a little bit fibrotic on the left side. Sometimes if they've been on a lot of steroids, everything's kind of falling apart. It just feels very friable and not great. Luckily, I have not had anybody perforate before I got to surgery. I'm going to say in 12 to 15 years, it's been a really long time since I've seen anybody like that. So, and you know, it can perforate too. So even though it's mucosal, it can get sick enough, but it is sometimes underwhelming when I'm taking out a colon. It looks way worse on the inside than it does on the outside, but occasionally kind of yucky.
Oh, that's kind of sad, but good to know that the colon needed to come out.
Yeah, for sure. And I think, you know, that kind of reminds me of this shared decision-making topic that we really want to focus on today, because, you know, you mentioned, Michael, that there's new medications coming. So the first thing that came to mind is, do we have to wait for any milestones like puberty or anything like that, that we try to push forward with, or do any of those external things come into play? And then the other thing that I don't want to forget to mention, because we did have a request for this episode specifically to talk about shared decision making and tools that you may provide to patients, such as, I think that Improve Care Now has a new app to help with that. And so what are some of these other things that come into mind when you're making this decision with the family?
Well, I don't seek to delay a surgery for pubertal development or till they get older. You know, sometimes we do have families will say, well, I want my child to be older so they can make this decision for themselves. And that can be difficult to walk them through, particularly if, you know, when you're confident that this is the right option for their child and takes some time. And you have to be patient. You have to be curious about what their fears and goals and motivations are. And through maintaining that relationship with the family, I think asking good questions, you can usually get them to where they need to be over time. But it can sometimes take more time than you'd like as the provider. Developmentally, the only age consideration that I have is the younger a child is, you know, say, let's say younger than 7 or 6 with colitis, there is a greater chance that it could potentially be Crohn's colitis. So moving forward to a J pouch in those most young patients, you're sort of a proceed with caution, and there may be some extra steps to convince yourself that this is truly ulcerative colitis. For instance, doing a 3-stage, making sure you have a good review of the pathology, possibly scoping again before the next stages in those youngest patients.
That's very interesting. Would you consider doing like MRIs again or capsule again, or would you just scope before you reconnect in younger ages?
I think it depends on the patient, but once you've done a colectomy, you have very nice access to the small bowel. Right. So I think generally a scope through the stoma and in the remaining rectal stump can be very useful in those settings where you have uncertainty about the diagnosis. But the surgical pathology should be very helpful too. You have the whole colon, or at least most
look
of
at,
it. Look
yeah.
at,
yeah.
Lots of pathology specimens.
Yeah. Dissecting it all, looking at it all.
And then this Improved Care Now tool, is this something you've ever seen before or taken a look at?
Yeah, I have reviewed the tool. I think it's a very nice resource for families. It's not restricted to ulcerative colitis surgery, but any inflammatory bowel disease surgery. So it's sort of a general resource. And I think it does a nice job of helping families organize their thinking. And it, getting back to some of the things I talked to before, what are their feelings about surgery? What are their goals for their health and their function? And it may help them organize their questions or what information they need to come through the end and make a decision about surgery.
Yeah, definitely a very helpful tool. So as a surgeon, gastroenterologist, we kind of collaborated with the patient. Patients use the Improved Care Now decision-making tool, and the decision was to proceed with surgery. Lisa, so after you make the decision to proceed with surgery, and we're talking about non-emergent surgeries right here, because we did a great job and we sent the patient before they got sick. What is the ideal timing of surgery in relation to, like, while they're on steroids, how many doses of biologics they got, optimizing nutrition?
Well, obviously, the perfect surgical candidate is not on steroids, has perfect nutrition, and never needed a biologic, but then likely they don't need surgery either. So we are not, unfortunately, left with those patients. But ideally, kind of a lot of these things will sort of determine what kind of operation I do or how many stages I do. So if you're on steroids, if you've been taking a lot of biologics, if you have poor nutrition, then I'm going to be really conservative and give you a 3-stage procedure. And like Dr. Rosen said, should you be a younger person, it's more likely that you have the propensity to become a Crohn's patient or have Crohn's to start with. We want that specimen to be able to diagnose this. So lots of different factors go into how we stage procedures. So ideally, off of steroids for 6 weeks, that's what the studies show. Good nutrition with a normal Z score also helps you have better outcomes with this. Do I delay surgery because of that? Not necessarily, but I will change what I do if somebody actually needs an operation. So 3 stages if you're sick, potentially 2 stages if you're not as sick. So colon and do the J pouch at once, colon, rectum, do the J pouch, give them a stoma, protect it, because your J pouch lives in an area that has an increased risk of an anastomotic leak. So small intestine isn't supposed to live at your anus. And when we attach that together, there's an increased risk of, there's some tension on that and, you know, potentially a compromised blood supply because there's a little bit of a stretch on it. And so we want to make sure that that's protected. At least I do. Pelvic sepsis is something that I don't want to deal with in a child, and the child doesn't want to deal with it either. It's pretty terrible. You can get really sick and end up in the intensive care unit, it's not fun, and it potentially decreases the function of your J pouch later on in life. So I want to make a really good J pouch the first time. So two stages is going to be my limit. I'm not a single stage person ever. But the kids that are healthy, in quotes, are going to be the ones that potentially could have a two stage versus a three stage procedure in my practice.
And for our listeners that might be trainees or residents, can you just tell us briefly what one stage is, two stages, and three stages? You kind of alluded to it a little bit, but just to kind of say, this is one stage, this is two stage, and this is three stage.
Absolutely. So one stage is when your colon and your rectum are removed at the same time, and then a J pouch out of your small intestine is created, it's reconnected, and there's no stoma, it's not protected. Two stages can be done in two different ways, well, probably more, but definitely there are two ways that are really well described. The one that I described before is the traditional two-stage. So take your colon and rectum out, make a J pouch, and then protect it with a loop ileostomy. That's classic. Another way to do it is to do a colectomy first with a protecting ileostomy, and then later go back and do a proctectomy in a J pouch without protection, so no stoma. So it's only two operations. And the most conservative is what I mainly do, which is a three stage. So colon comes out the first stage, stoma and ileostomy after that. Second stage, rectum gets removed, J pouch is made, and then the loop ileostomy is then placed to protect the anastomosis that you just made. And then the third stage, I do a rigid procto and then take down the stoma. So put the small intestine back together and then they poop out of their bottoms.
Yeah, that was very helpful. And then just to kind of get your input, Michael, would you add anything to pre-surgical management for these patients? When would you consider TPN or stopping the biologic or anything like that?
Yeah, I think if a patient's malnourished and not taking enough sufficiently by mouth, TPN is important going into surgery, right after surgery, to optimize their nutrition. And that being said, any patient that's sick with a central line with UC needs to be on thromboprophylaxis. But the other point I want to make is that if a patient is sick with ulcerative colitis and it's all determined that surgery is necessary, it should not be delayed for them to get to a better nutritional status. The colon should come out and then they work on the nutrition after that initial subtotal or abdominal colectomy. In terms of the medications, you know, you got to this point because nothing's working. So you can reduce the steroids because they weren't helping. So at least bring them down. You can bring them safely down to 20, you know, or so prior to the surgery. And that might mitigate the risk from steroids a little bit. Biologics, you know, I think we have pretty good data now from our adult colleagues about the safety of surgery around infliximab and anti-TNFs, at least. We don't have as much data about other biologics, but there doesn't seem to be a need to delay surgery around biologic administration.
Can we kind of rush past this thromboprophylaxis comment? But I do want to like highlight that a little bit. So what do you use? And especially if we're going to be using like Lovenox, I can imagine how that might interact with potential surgical treatments that are coming up. So what do you do for that? And Lisa, specifically, what are your preference for thromboprophylaxis?
We use Lovenox and we do, we hold it the day before surgery. And then in the operating room, I give 5,000 units of subQ heparin. So it is, you know, we're doing dissection in a fairly long case on a patient that has inflammatory disease. So they're set up for DVT. And those are something that we can prevent, but we have a difficult time treating. So much easier to prevent it than not. These are not bloody operations for the most part. These are bloodless, well, not bloodless, but I don't think I lose more than 5 to 10 cc's of blood doing a colectomy or a proctectomy. And so it is, I think, extremely important. And it doesn't bother me that they've been on Lovenox. And yesterday I did an operation on a kid who had a sinus venous thrombosis, and so has been on Xarelta, which is a new drug for me, being in peds. And she held it the day before and will start 3 days after. But in the interim, she's getting Lovenox as she recovers from her surgery. So it is, I don't think any surgeon should be afraid to operate on blood thinners. And I think it's very important for the patients to get it. And I would actually mirror what Dr. Rosen said about not preventing surgery or not, avoiding surgery just because of the patient's condition. If they need the operation, it's really actually quite safe for them to get a colectomy done at least. And my experience is only in laparoscopic colectomy. I haven't done a lot of open colons in my entire career, actually, because of how things have changed, I guess. But patients end up tolerating them very well. They recover pretty quickly. And once you can get them eating again, their nutrition recovers pretty quickly too. So sometimes need TPN, but generally it's not for before surgery. It's more for after surgery.
Yeah. So definitely don't fear the Lovenox. Talk to your surgeons about it. It is definitely okay, it sounds like, to move forward with that to prevent these thromboembolisms.
I have two follow-up questions to Michael. Michael, do you ever consider triple or quadruple antibiotics? And usually these patients have low albumin. Would you ever consider giving them albumin pre-op?
First, can I take a moment to be in awe of like what Lisa and her colleagues are able to do in surgery through laparoscopy? I mean, entire colon is removed through a 3-inch incision, maybe even smaller. It's remarkable.
It really is. And 5 to 10 cc's, don't forget, 5 to 10 cc's of blood.
So, Tamara, regarding quadruple antibiotics, there is some evidence that there's at least one randomized study that quadruple antibiotics, and the typical protocol inpatient is metro, doxy, vanc, and amox taken orally, can improve the rapidity of response to steroids in acute severe ulcerative colitis. I'd say in practice, we use it when we're running out of solutions. I think now that we have some other, so first of all, it's a bridge therapy, right? That's not a long-term solution. I think its efficacy is still, we still would have things to learn about it. It's not entirely proven. And, you know, in recent days, I have other options like JAK inhibitors. So I would say I don't use them routinely, but there are situations, unique situations where I'll use them when I'm looking for a bridge therapy, potentially to maybe to give a medicine that we just started more time if the family's really trying to avoid surgery or sometimes in the outpatient setting.
About albumin.
I'd be interested in what Lisa thinks about the need for albumin. The albumin's gonna get lost as soon as you give it. Yeah. So if they have symptoms, if they're edematous related to their hypoalbuminemia, usually not. Then I would administer it, but I don't typically give albumin.
Agree.
Yeah. So I want to talk about the actual surgery a little bit. And I know, Lisa, you said, hey, it's just a couple hours. We do all these things. But some of the things that you're doing are so intricate and intense. And especially, you know, I think a lot about pelvic floor dysfunction. I think a lot of gastroenterologists do. So can you just talk a little bit about your approach to dissecting around these pelvic arteries and nerves? And what kind of risks do we have for them long term? I know, Michael, you mentioned having pelvic floor therapists can be very helpful. So fill that in for me a little bit.
Sure. Actually, pelvic floor dysfunction is not the first thing I think about when I talk about risks for this operation, but it's an interesting idea. I'll start with that and then we'll go through the things that I normally think about and talk about. But I think that if you have pelvic floor dysfunction preoperatively, that sets you up for issues afterwards. And that's something that we don't do or think about very much in children because kids tend not to have too much of that, right? If you've had 3 kids, if you've been pooping poorly your entire life, then you're kind of set up for that, probably just dysfunctional stooling or even having trauma to your pelvic floor before can cause problems and create issues with more incontinence than we would normally see in a child that doesn't have these things. So I haven't seen a ton of this, but in terms of the operation, potentially, maybe I'm doing something right. I don't know. When I first learned how to do a J pouch, we were doing open surgery, and that's a totally different ball game than doing it laparoscopically. So when you have an open incision, there is this very ugly retractor called the St. Mark's. And I call it ugly because I think I had to hold it for like 5 hours one time when I was an intern and I kept getting my hand like tapped and it hurt a lot. So it does potentially a lot of damage because you're retracting up on the deep, deep tissues in the pelvis in order for the surgeon to get down as deep as they can in this dark little hole. Not an ideal operation that way. But when you switch to laparoscopy, you can get really deep in the pelvis without, and you can see really well, and your instruments can move really nicely, and you can make these nice little delicate movements down there. I have the additional advantage of having a 3D scope that I use, so it's just beautiful binocular vision down there. I don't use a robot. I know some people do, and they really like that. But you can get really right down on the rectum. We're not doing cancer surgery, so I don't have to go and take out the entire mesorectum for these usually. And so just if you stay very, very close to the rectum and you do good traction on the rectum, you can get just right on that rectal wall and you miss everything. You don't touch or see anything else. And your retraction is really actually quite minimal in the surrounding tissues. So it's almost like a no-touch proctectomy in a sense, but it is, I haven't had a lot of these issues. Now, could you staple wrong? Sure. Have there been issues in which people have created a rectovaginal fistula? Yes. Those things can happen, but I think knowing that those things can happen helps you avoid those problems. But then, you know, should somebody have some issues, then certainly pelvic floor therapists are very helpful. Biofeedback can be very helpful for kids too. I think that in terms of incontinence or issues with seepage at night, Imodium helps, fiber, that kind of stuff, changing diets around a little bit so you're not eating so much late at night, or maybe eating more thickening foods at night can help too. So there are a lot of different things that can be done, but I think, you know, making a good shape pouch, doing a nice dissection is number one, and then we deal with the other stuff later.
Okay. So you mentioned that, you know, during the procedure, you now can make these really delicate movements. So what are the most expected post-operative outcomes that you're really looking for, that you prepare people for?
So after, it's really mostly after the third stage. So after the first stage, the thing that they have to get used to is the stoma. Right? They have to recover from whatever illness that they had before, how sick they were before, make sure that their nutrition gets better. They're able to eat by mouth and stoma out. It's okay. They know how to manage the stoma, that kind of stuff. Second stage is mainly recovering just from the operation, which is usually pretty quick. But I like to keep kids in the hospital for a little bit longer because I've used some of their small intestine to make the J pouch. And then the stoma is a little bit more proximal, so they just have less surface area to absorb their food. So sometimes they have increased dumping. And so we want to make sure that they're not dehydrated before they leave the hospital. So sometimes it's really boring. They're just sitting there trying to thicken their stool so that they can leave the hospital. After the third stage, that's usually a pretty quick recovery. They're in the hospital overnight. We're just taking down the stoma, dropping it back in. Right away, I talk about how stooling is going to be, and it's going to be more liquid stool. It's only going to be liquid stool, maybe a little pasty. And they get a butt bag from us. So part of the multidisciplinary team we have are nurses that help us with perianal care. And so there's some nice barrier ointments that we give everybody because they're going to be stooling 12 to 20 times a day at the beginning. They need to figure out how to use their J pouch. And some kids will run to the bathroom when they think they have to fart too. And sometimes when they do fart, there's a little bit of liquid that comes out. So it's a little bit scary for them. And it's just a matter of adaptation and getting used to it. And it takes time. Usually for most of my kids, in a couple of weeks, they kind of start to figure it out and it's not quite so bad. Usually they have some nighttime seepage or even stooling when they're really, really sleepy. Usually just in the hospital, occasionally at home too, and we'll use chucks on their bed at home, or even like a diaper kind of situation if it's significant. And then we talk about these other drugs like Imodium to help, fibers, changing their diet, that kind of stuff to make that a little bit better. But generally, most people don't do a lot of nighttime stooling. They'll usually wake up, and like Dr. Rosen said, 0 to 1 times a night is the hope. And I usually quote 4 to 8 bowel movements a day for my kids. So maybe a little bit more than Dr. Rosen's. Very, very rarely do I have a kid who tells me they poop twice a day. And I don't know if I believe that or not when they tell me that, but they sometimes do. So the biggest thing that I tell folks to look out for is pouchitis. So that's inflammation of their J pouch. The simple surgical way that I look at it is stool is not supposed to be in your small intestine for any length of time. And since we're using your small intestine as a storage device, it has increased risk of having bacteria kind of grow in there. And so sometimes your J pouch can get inflamed. That's probably my simplistic way. I don't think that's necessarily all the etiology of it, but that's what I say. And generally, we can treat that with antibiotics. I say at least 50% of patients will get that once in their life. Sometimes it's a little bit more. And sometimes people get pouchitis over and over again. And if that's the case, then we need to treat them differently and, again, in a multidisciplinary fashion. Pouchitis, I tell them, is when they feel like almost they have a flare of ulcerative colitis again. They can have increased stooling, sometimes blood, sometimes fever and pain. And I send them home with a prescription, usually for Cipro. And I say, just get this filled. If you start having these symptoms, start taking the medications and give us a call. And then usually in a couple of days, it should get better. If it doesn't, I want another call and I potentially see you in the hospital. So that's number one. The other thing is they have no colon any longer, and they've been dealing with this potential problem with dehydration with their stoma the whole time, but they really have to focus on that. We live in Arizona. It is dry here to start with. They need to really always concentrate on hydration. We actually give them a water bottle from the hospital here when they leave so that they are reminded to drink all the time. I want them to pee 5 to 6 times a day clear. And so they're hopefully looking at their pee. Before we do surgery, we talk about the risk of infertility with girls, especially. That's a topic that takes a little bit of time in the first meeting. Just doing a pelvic dissection can increase the risk of infertility. We know that it can be up to 30% in people with open surgery. We really don't know what it is with laparoscopic surgery. There are lots of different ways to do laparoscopic surgery. And so I think that if we can make it consistent for everyone. Potentially, it takes time to study. We do kids, so it's harder for us to know exactly what their infertility rate is, but we talk about that always. In the adult studies, it says that males have better fertility after surgery. I'm not sure if that's necessarily true or not. But with boys, we talk about the potential for retrograde ejaculation, which could definitely affect their fertility. So, in the older kids, at least, we do a lot of talking about this, and the younger kids as well, but in a different way. And then obviously, pouch failure in general, what kinds of things can make you not have a pouch anymore or not have a pouch that's functional anymore? So chronic pouchitis can be this if it's really bad and severe and you're on medications all the time. Certainly, if you convert to Crohn's, then we need to talk about, and if you have Crohn's in your J pouch, then we need to talk about ways to treat that. There are so many drugs out here now that we didn't have before that it's actually gotten better. And to the fact that sometimes I will do a J pouch in a kid who does have Crohn's, as long as the small intestine in that area looks okay and it's well controlled, with the risk that they may end up needing a permanent stoma later. The other thing is if they are incontinent, like continually incontinent, this is more for adults. I don't see this as much in children, but incontinence and nighttime soilage can make people not want to live with a J pouch anymore. So since they have, most all my patients have experience living with a stoma, they know what that's like versus what the J pouch is. And so if the J pouch is intolerable to them or makes them sick, then that's a reason to get rid of it. The other thing, this is forever, like I told you, it takes an hour.
This is very, really great information.
I leave a cuff. When I do my operation, I do a double stapled anastomosis. And so there's a little bit of a rim of tissue above the dentate line that's rectum that has ulcerative colitis. And I leave it there. And it's usually 1 to 2 centimeters. I leave it there because I feel like it's important for continence. And also that it's actually a little easier, right? I have a little bit, I don't have to go quite as low for my J pouch. And because of that, I need to do monitoring yearly, so a digital rectal exam every year to make sure that's okay. But also, some people can get what's called cuffitis, so inflammation of that cuff. That usually can be treated with topical treatments, but occasionally people will have severe bleeding from just that little cuff itself, and despite treatments, and may require another operation to actually remove the cuff and do a mucosectomy and then pull down the J pouch.
That was really great information. And about kind of, there's more.
There's more. And you can have, a twist of your J pouch.
You can have
internal hernia. You can get adhesions. You can have like things that require other operations.
Are these common?
No.
Okay.
No, but they are complications. They are
complications,
things that
can happen. Yeah.
You can have prolapse of your J pouch that I never thought could happen, but it does.
Wow. That's very interesting. Kind of like a rectal prolapse.
Exactly like a rectal prolapse.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Rosen, when we talk about kind of a colectomy, we say, oh, maybe this is the treatment of ulcerative colitis. You get a colectomy and your ulcerative colitis is treated, or at least that's kind of the thought process. But we kind of learned there's still a rectal stump there. What does the medical therapy look like after a colectomy? And Lisa spoke a lot about kind of the complications. How do you manage those, some of those, especially pouchitis, kind of medically? We can have a whole episode about pouchitis, but in kind of the upcoming treatments, we know in the past it was probably VSL and antibiotics, but is there anything new?
I don't like using the word cure with yes. colectomy for ulcerative colitis. And so I try to dispel that. I tell patients, you're trading a serious set of problems right now for a new kind of physiology that is likely to result in much better function, outcome, quality of life for you. I said earlier, there's about an 80% chance you won't need to be on meds. So I agree with Lisa that in about the first year or two, the chance of acute pouchitis is about 50%. Over the course of 10 years, it's 80% of patients probably will have an episode of acute pouchitis. And then as Lisa said, that can go on in a smaller percentage, maybe 15-20% of patients to either antibiotic dependent or antibiotic refractory pouchitis. There are other things that can cause inflammation in the pouch or sort of inflammatory problems of the pouch. Cuffitis is another one. It's treated differently. I agree with topicals. You can have infections of the pouch, and that's important to rule out. And rarely even ischemia of the pouch causing inflammation. So with regard to medical therapy directly after surgery, I'm usually not using medical therapy after surgery. Occasionally when they're in between the first and second stage and they have a good portion of rectum left, they can continue to have some bleeding from that. And sometimes we'll consider treating that with topicals, but things weren't working before that surgery. So I'm not sure the likelihood of it working afterwards. But when a patient has increased frequency, abdominal cramping, urgency, symptoms consistent with pouchitis, generally I ask them to submit a stool sample for at least C. diff and possibly consider also for molecular studies for pathogens, for bacterial pathogens, because you absolutely can get C. diff of the pouch, and that might be treated differently. Pouchitis can be treated usually with either Cipro or metronidazole, and there's benefits and problems with each. Sometimes people use a combination. There was recently published a nice comparative effectiveness study that doesn't support the use of them in combination as any better than one or the other. And I don't like putting kids on more medicines than they need to be on, and the families don't like it either. But I think a really important point is if they're not responding to antibiotics, or if, within a couple months, they have another episode, don't just keep using the antibiotics. That may be the answer in the future, but that is the time to perform a pouchoscopy, determine if there is indeed pouch inflammation, if there are ulcers in the pre-pouch terminal ileum that would be more consistent with Crohn's disease, if there's any anatomic abnormalities of the pouch, if it's inflammation limited to the cuff. I'm sure it wouldn't happen if Lisa performed the surgery, but is the cuff really long? these are the things that need to be evaluated. I know we could go on a long time about that. I do think it's important to know how to examine a pouch endoscopically. And, and very briefly, it's important to evaluate, biopsy, and comment on at least three portions: the pre-pouch ileum, the body of the pouch, and the rectal cuff. And so that's an important point I'd like to convey to the listeners.
Tamara, let's definitely do an episode on this.
Yes.
I think we need to have a full conversation about this because there's so much to learn, so much that's changing. And I think having that conversation is really a good way to get that message out there. So all of that to say, Lisa and Michael, this has just been so phenomenal. I think, like we said earlier, bringing that message out there that really surgical therapy for ulcerative colitis is one of our treatment options. And that's my number one takeaway from this discussion. But Lisa, Michael, we normally give three. If you could give two or three takeaways from your standpoint on, you know, on this discussion today, what would they be? I don't know, Lisa, maybe you can go first.
So agree with you. Talk to your surgeon early. Get us involved. We need to work as a team all together with this. Surgery isn't scary. And find, if you don't have a surgeon kind of picked out at your institution, find someone who's really interested in IBD, because you're going to find someone, and then start a relationship with them so that you guys can work together really closely, because it'll just benefit your patients. We're not scary.
You definitely don't look scary.
Michael, what about from your side? What are your big takeaways from this discussion?
I would add that in the right setting, surgery is a good option to get someone who's had usually at this point terrible quality of life, really significant impairment of their quality of life, to much better function and quality of life near normal. And then the other point I'd like to make is if a patient is with a pouch, is not responding to empiric treatment for pouchitis or has recurrent episodes, do a scope, take a look at the pouch.
Great takeaways. Great takeaways. This is almost the end of our episode. We wish we can have you for hours and hours and hours.
Maybe over a hike. Like we could all be outside hiking.
Yeah. And talk continue about this pouchitis. And but great. This is the last question that we have for both of you. Looking back on your career, what has been the most valuable advice that you've received, and what advice do you have for our listeners?
When I was a fellow, so this is like 15 years ago or so, my mentor at the time, Brent Polk, he sent me an article from the Harvard Business Review by Schwartz and McCarthy. And the title of the article was "Manage Your Energy, Not Your Time." And it took me a few years after that to really latch on to that advice. But it absolutely was the best advice I got. And your to-do list will always be never ending and never be accomplishable, essentially. But if you manage your energy, if you sleep, if you spend time, you know, with your family, do some things that allow you, whatever that is, to decompress, exercise, you'll be more available to your patients. You'll be more effective for them. You'll be more effective and available for your mentees, for your family. And what you do get to on your to-do list, you'll be able to decide better and you'll do it better, you know, if you manage your energy. So that was the best advice I've received.
That's great. I need that on a t-shirt. Lisa?
Mine is actually just about the same in a sense. It's take care of yourself first and then you can take care of everyone else. So it was really important for me because when I started fellowship, I had an 8-week-old child. And all I could think about was taking care of my kid, even though I wasn't home at all. So really, really important. And that's, Michael is just much more eloquent in saying this than me. But yeah, same idea.
Kind of like get outside, going back to the beginning of our conversation, go hike every day. That sounds like a dream. We just need to bring some mountains to Ohio tomorrow. Mm-hmm. How can we do this? We have no mountains here.
Just hills.
You have rivers, right? You can walk along the river.
Well, that's true. That's true.
There are beautiful parks in Ohio.
There are.
As a
okay.
Former Ohioan.
That's true. Well, thank you both for spending this time with us today. We were so happy to have you on Bowel Sounds. And we'll have to catch up with you at a future conference.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you. This is a real honor.
Well, that was a great episode. It's good to have kind of a collaboration between surgery and gastroenterology and kind of see the thought process of both. So great episode.
Yeah, I think it's definitely drawn to light that we are going to have future inflammatory bowel disease episodes just because we had so much more that we could keep talking about. So yeah, we'll be planning those in the future.
If you don't already, be sure to follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Bowel Sounds and on Facebook at Pediatric GI Podcast for the latest news and updates on upcoming episodes. If you like what you heard and want to support the podcast, it would really help us if you did one or all of the following three things. One, tell one person about the podcast. Two, leave a review on Apple Podcasts to help others discover our podcast. And three, on our Buzzsprout page, there's a link to support the show by making a donation to the NASPGHAN Foundation. You can also get there through www.naspghan.org. And four, maybe go onto our merch website. The link is in the show notes. And buy some Vowel Sounds merch.
I wear my sweatshirt all the time.
Me too.
They do run a little small.
Well, it depends on kind of which one you choose, because some run a little bit big. There's so much to choose from. That's amazing.
True. Yeah, that's true.
But the money you donate helps support some of the amazing things that NASPGHAN Foundation is doing, including supporting pediatric GI research and public education programs.
And as always, the discussion, views, and recommendations of this podcast are the sole responsibility of the host and the guest and are subject to change with advances in the field. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, everybody.
Bye, everyone.